Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We got a lot of stuff to talk about today. We're moving on from the Trump era, and I guess one of the things moving on from the Trump era is that you get to news days where there's a lot going on, but there's a lot of different things going on. There's not necessarily kind of like a unified, you know, with Trump, there's always like, what did Trump do? And, you know, in the Trump administration, it was, it's not just the Trump administration as kind of like Trump is a rubric to organize the whole federal government under his presidency. It's the Trump administration. It's the Donald Trump administration, because he's the only one who really does anything. And to the extent that other people do things, they only, toady to him or are in trouble with him. And the Biden administration is different. We've got a series of confirmations going on. It's taken a while. I think that departments, they sometimes take a while, but usually pretty right out of the bat to get the big ones done. And that's why I was a little surprised. It took a little while to get Merrick Garland confirmed. I think they did, if I remember right, Yellen and Blinken and maybe one or two other people were confirmed almost like the day of, I think. But so you got that going on. You have the progress of the COVID relief bill that's moving along. You got stuff going on in Texas, still really a kind of a catastrophic situation with sort of the comic relief of the junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz. And then you have this hearing yesterday about the Capitol insurrection that took place on January 6th. We're going to talk about that. And it's a funny thing because it didn't really learn too much. It was all the people who got canned within, a day or two saying, I didn't know it was going to happen. You know, it's kind of like, okay, I guess that's why he got fired. It's, sort of plausible. That is an interesting thing. It's pretty rare in public life these days in the United States where you see something like that, where I think within a day or two, every person who had top authority for security on the Capitol was gone, resigned, fired. The head of the Capitol Police was, again, fired, resigned, sort of same difference. He was out. I believe both sergeant-at-arms in the House and the Senate were both fired. And it's a funny thing. We don't see that a lot anymore. And kind of like, sort of makes sense. I mean, you really blew it. Right. I mean, it's sort of like, most of the time having a Capitol Police force is kind of inherently sort of overkill, right? Or just kind of an office complex, right? Not a lot of SWAT situations. Certainly never a time when like there's like the equivalent of home invasion, right? Kind of like, and you just weren't paying attention and it all kind of blew up. So they were out. But the real stuff we want to know about is kind of things happen with the president or what's going on with the investigation or what groups or stuff like that. Anyway, we're going to talk about all that stuff with my two colleagues. But before Before we get there, remember that Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is the sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. As I learned just recently, notwithstanding having been a Grady's consumer for years and years and years, that it's made with a special blend of 100% Arabica beans. I kind of learned what Arabica beans, I mean, I heard that like on coffee commercials since I was a little kid, right? Like 45 years ago, I've been hearing about Arabica beans, but I got a little mini tutorial from, I think, from David about what the deal is with those.
You're welcome,
Yeah, well, the special blend also has, in addition to Arabica beans, it has French chicory and signature spices, and you can brew it overnight to give you a velvety smooth cup. You can drink iced or hot or spiked in a cocktail, any way you want. Treat yourself to a gourmet cup of coffee without stepping foot outside, all for less than a buck a cup. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. All right, Dave and Kate, what is going on?
Well, before we get going, I actually have a little Grady's update to share with you guys. If you remember last week, in the midst of moving and, you know, changing apartments and all that, my last Grady's order was delivered to my old address. Well, our former neighbor generously reached out, let me know that he had the package and I could kind of swing by and come grab it. So all is well in the iced coffee land, which is nice.
Cool.
Before we get to the Capitol security hearing, I thought we could talk a little bit about Neera Tanden's nomination for the director of the Office of Management and Budget. This morning, I think her two confirmation hearings were postponed, one in front of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and then also the Senate Budget Committee, which I believe Bernie Sanders chairs at this point, the latter of those. Josh, before we got going, you were kind of talking about how maybe her Bernie opposition has come back to bite her a little bit, but kind of swirling around all of this is some kind of mean tweets she had resurfacing, calling Mitch McConnell Voldemort, I think, calling Susan Collins the worst. You know, and all of a sudden Republicans
are... This is a family-friendly podcast. Can you rein it in?
Apologies. Yes. Cover your children's ears if you're listening.
He must not be named.
in public, yeah. You know, I guess swirling around all this is her old tweets, and it's pretty rich after 4 or 5 years of Republicans literally pretending that they have no idea what Twitter is. They didn't see Trump's latest tweets. They couldn't possibly have time to follow everything he said. You know, some relatively benign Twitter critiques are coming back to haunt Neera Tanden. Josh, tell us about like the Bernie connection and why you think that also might be a, you know, at play here in some of the potential.
Well, I think it's, and when I say Bernie, I don't mean literally Bernie. I mean this, you know, she was, Neera's you know, fault or crime, to the extent there is one, and I don't think there is one, but what, it's not really mean tweets. It's that she became, more than is often the case for someone in her position, she's the head of, you know, is, I guess, is still the head of CAP, Center for American Progress, you know, a big sort of Twitter pugilist. Right. With and very much, you know, Neera was an aide for, you know, in the old days, an aide to Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, got very into those endless arguments on Twitter between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And, you know, that's usually people in her position keep it a little tighter, right? And she, you know, I don't know if it's feeding the trolls, but, you know, kind of into these little, you know, kind of feuds and stuff. And so she became really a lightning rod for the, you know, the kind of the Sanders progressive scene on Twitter. And to a certain extent, you know, there's this thing she had with you know, Matt Brunig years ago, which was that before 2016? I can't remember this thing. It's too complicated to even go into, but she, you know, for people in that world, she became sort of like the emblem of, you know, establishment Democrats and neoliberalism and all this kind of stuff. And there is some weird way in which that animus, that, you know, that kind of feuding that she had going, which was an intra-democratic party thing, became well enough known that Republicans kind of took it up. And that's kind of one of the funny, you know, one of the funny things here, because that really is the trajectory. I mean, she called Susan Collins the worst. I mean, the worst. That's like I don't even know what to call that. The worst. Is that like calling someone like a, I don't even know. You know, I'm more creative with words. It's comical that that's like a mean tweet. So it's really it all starts with that, and kind of that is, to the extent her Twitter feuding was a thing, it was almost, you know, largely overwhelmingly intra-democratic stuff, and again I'm just kind of curious how it kind of jumped over there, because the things that people talk about, it's pretty mild stuff. And even when, you know, obviously it's absurd, you know, in light of Donald Trump, but even like there are a lot of people sort of the other thing is that Donald Trump never got anybody confirmed. He never actually nominated anybody, which kind of gets around this issue, right? I find the whole thing unfortunate. I think she'd be good in the position. Think she's a good egg, a very knowledgeable person, a very committed person. So I think the whole thing is too bad. And my best sense that of what happened here, I hope this is what it is. Not that this would be good, but it would. It would indirectly kind of portend some other positive things, is that Joe Manchin felt that he needed to find a thing where he could go up against the White House and kind of show, like, you know, my being centrist and this and that and the other, it's not just talk. You know, there's going to be times where I can't, you know, where I have to go against you and really kind of break your heart and stuff like that. And that he needs to do it here because he's not going to do it on, you know, he's going to vote for the relief bill. He's going to, on the substantive things, he's going to be with the Democratic caucus, which if he's not is a big, big problem for everybody in the Democratic Party, for Biden, blah, 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 blah. And that he perhaps sees this as, you know, you can get another OMB director. And I don't know whether Neera will just stay at CAP or whether Biden will just appoint her to, you know, every president has a lot of senior advisors who are just advisors. They don't have to be nominated or confirmed by anybody. I hate this that this is happening, and I do feel like there's a lot of, let's just say, I think she's being judged by a standard I have not seen anybody, frankly, judged by. And, you know, maybe not for me to say kind of exactly why that is, but it seems pretty clear that it's the case. And it bums me out, frankly. But I think and I hope that is it. Not because that is good or acceptable, but that if it is the case, it at least suggests that Manchin is going to be, you know, going to be there as a vote on the kind of the big substantive legislative stuff.
Yeah, you know, I didn't realize the people of West Virginia were so interested in the machinations of the OMB. Like, I think your reading of Manchin is probably right, but it still drives me insane because...
Yeah, it sucks. It's not supposed to be gross.
Independence for the sake of independence. Like, the point that he's not always supposed to be with the Democrats is, you know, supposed to be because he is has a more moderate ideology. So he's not always going to be on board with, you know, a more progressive stance on things. And you can dislike that too. But that is the point of it. It's not supposed to be, here's a list of times where I made their lives harder just because. Like, that's not what political independence is supposed to be. He's supposed to be not going along with the Biden administration when there is something that he feels ideologically opposed on. And that is not what is happening here. You know, just making, you know, kind of like removing people's ability to have a position they'd be well suited for just to show your independence as this like amorphous concept is just so stupid to me. Also, I don't know how kind of firmed up this is, but I saw kind of chatter that he is being at least wishy-washy on Deb Haaland as well, who's the nominee for the Interior Department, Interior Secretary. And, you know, that's going to become a narrative. If the only cabinet appointees that he has an issue with are women of color.
Well, and he also had the thing with Harris.
Right.
Right. I mean it's not.
Remind us on that, Josh. What was his issue there?
That
with
was
Harris?
This thing, this kind of absurd thing where she did like a radio hit on like a Charleston, West Virginia radio station or something and didn't give him a heads up. I mean, what?
And then the White House spent like 2 days groveling in touch with Manchin and this and
that. Yeah, and like, whatever. I mean, that was like, you know, kind of at the end of the day, who cares? I mean, nothing really happened. It was just sort of like a little fit. You know, the thing with the weird thing is that the Haaland thing would actually make a little more sense in as much as that she is really a climate hawk and the Interior Department has, you know, a profound input on climate stuff. And West Virginia is a coal state. So like that is not something he's just kind of pulling out of thin air. I mean, I would be incredibly disappointed if he opposes her, but at least there'd be some kind of logic. Whereas the Neera thing is just, it's just absurd. The whole thing is, I mean, and again, it's not just, it's not just like hypocritical because of Trump. It's just the whole thing is absurd. I mean, again, even the things that, calling Susan Collins the worst. I mean, my God. I mean, this is, I mean, you know, by the standards of sort of like, you know, mainstream political discourse on Twitter, she's like a kind of like a 3 for intensity or, you know, laceration or something like that. I mean, it'd be one thing if she said something like, and this is purely hypothetical because she said nothing like this, has been accused of saying nothing. But if someone said something like, God, you know, I don't wish anybody dead, but I wish that person dead, you know, or something really kind of like, well, you know, you can't really come back from that. Or I don't know, just something. But I mean, Voldemort, I mean, come on.
And the other part of this is just like even putting aside the obvious, ridiculous, you know, Trump hypocrisy, that sounds really crappy message to be like, if you criticize the most powerful people in our society, these elected officials, you will not be welcome to work at the government. Like, is that really the free speech message we want to be sending here? That these people, you can't criticize them or you can't work with them? I mean, the whole thing is just so deeply dumb to me. And I hate that Manchin is kind of participating in this ridiculous Republican charade, you know, and by that standard, you know, kind of giving them a prize for staking out this ridiculous bad faith position. They're going to win on it. You know, her nomination's going to be dead.
It's also, you know, she'll be fine. And look, politics is not fair. You're not entitled to, like, you know, confirmation and stuff like that. I mean, she, you know, she's head of CAP, which is an incredibly influential, powerful position within the sort of the, you know, Democratic progressive policy world, blah, 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 blah. But it just sucks to me because I know, I mean, not close with Neera, but I know her. I've known her for many years. And she's just a very smart, accomplished person. She's not a policy wonk in the sense of some people are like they're a healthcare policy person or they're a fiscal policy, you know, all these kind of things. But someone who kind of has operated in the whole policy world for a couple decades – and is just, again, incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly able. And like, OMB is like a really, that makes sense as a position for her. And she's just kind of, as I said, being sacrificed because of this nonsensical kind of just absurd thing. I mean, again, I really hope that there's no problem with Deb Haaland's nomination, but at least there is a policy substance issue that Manchin, given where he comes from on fossil fuels, could, you know, be concerned about. But the near thing is just absurd, and it's a waste, and I feel, you know, she'll be fine, but it sucks.
And the other piece of it that bugs me is pre-Georgia runoffs, Republicans had already staked out their position that they were going to kill her nomination, that she was going to be kind of the, I mean, back then they were being more ambitious with their, right, the slate of nominees they were going to kill, but she was like top of the list then, you know, and then Democrats won the runoffs. And I'm sure that kind of like reignited some hope that she would get by. And then, you know, you just have Manchin buying into this.
I thought it was a given.
Bogus thing.
Yeah,
because it's so stupid, because no one can actually look at those criticisms and be like, yeah, no, totally valid. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I hate when Republicans are rewarded for these like intensely bad faith takes.
I mean, you sort of hinted at this, Kate, but, you know, imagine the nominee for OMB was a man, right? And he had a few confrontational tweets. I mean, I feel like people wouldn't even really bat an eye, right? It's she's, like Josh said, judged on a different standard. And yeah.
And there's also some of that. I mean, I don't want to get into the whole thing, but like, I met Neera and I met Annette, like introduced her. Hi, you know, it's not like I have some deep tie to Neera or know her well, but I was introduced to her, I think, in 2001. I was walking through Senator Clinton's office, and I believe she was the legislative director. Possibly she was an LA, but I think she was legislative director. In any case, you know, she's been in this world for a couple decades, but she became a public, you know, kind of in the Twitter sense, you know, kind of outside of just kind of insider wonky kind of stuff on Twitter in the last 5 or 6 years. And remember her, you know, it was like a bunch of her emails that were the hacked emails and all that kind of stuff. And the fact that she's, you know, a South Asian woman has always bulked pretty high in the kind of the intensity of animosity that that has surrounded her. I think that's just a fact, you know.
Well, and that's why I think if he pulls the same stunt with Deb Haaland's nomination, that's, you know, the second piece in this narrative. That's what all the headlines are going to be. And I think people are going to be even more mad because the historic nature of her candidacy, her being the first, she would be the first Native American to run a department that's obviously deeply involved in Native American interests. And in, so, you know, I don't know, but I think if he pulls it again, it's going to become a thing.
It won't just be bad for the two of them, the two nominees. It'll be bad for a kind of across the board, because that will, a lot of Democrats will be very angry just because, like, why are you doing this? Like, give Biden his appointees. But it will, the pattern will be so overwhelming. And then it's just a problem for the whole administration, because you need Manchin's vote. You just do. You absolutely positively need his vote. But I think it will be very hard for Biden to basically say, oh, we need his vote. So kind of like, cool, you know, proceed. That's going to get everybody in a bad, bad place. And I hope, whatever happens with Neera's nomination, I hope there are some people kind of, in the background kind of saying, look, these trains are going to collide at a certain point, like badly. So let's shift gears here and not get there.
I guess the one outstanding question on Tandon's nomination is whether Lisa Murkowski will support her, right? I mean, if Manchin opposes her and the entire rest of the Democratic caucus unites around her, which is still an open question. You know, Murkowski hasn't said how she would vote yet. I think there was some reporting yesterday, overnight, maybe in the last day or two, that the White House hasn't reached out to Murkowski yet. I know Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, yesterday said that Tandon had maybe 44 meetings or conversations with senators. Some of those are multiple meetings with the same people. There was some reporting from CNN, I want to say, this morning when the confirmation hearings were postponed, that Kyrsten Sinema was kind of undecided on Tandon as well. And so, you know, she's our other friend of
the pod. I have for years defended Manchin, not because I agree with kind of anything, but like he's a conservative Democrat. And I guarantee you there is no one else Democrats are getting elected in that state. Absolutely no one else. And kind of like, you know, and people saying, well, he's, you know, he's just a Republican. He could be a Republican any day he wants to. Any day. I guarantee you. Guarantee you. And this is just, you know, and he's very bad on climate, you know, because coal's a huge thing in his state and he's got all these things, but it just kind of is what it is. And you know, there's partisans are always kind of have this, you know, as you see similar things in more extreme, but similar things in the Republican Party of some people get elected as Democrats and they're just not what you think of as Democrats, but that's how they got elected. And that just kind of is what it is. But like some of these things are just like, dude, like some stuff's just being a dick. And like with Kyrsten Sinema, give me a fucking break. I mean, give me a fucking break. I mean, I don't know what, you know.
I mean, it's, like, it's the same category as like, look how independent I am on this stupid thing that has nothing to do with my ideology, but I like being a pain in the side of Democrats sometimes. I mean, I just don't even see the argument of like, well, this will help them run. Like, no, it won't. What, you're going to run ads saying, hey, I scuttled the nomination for this department that probably 99% of Americans have absolutely no idea what it is or what it does. You know, it's just dumb, endless dumb.
Yeah. Well, on that note, maybe that's a good, good point. We can transition to talking about the Capitol security hearings. So yesterday, Kate, you were heavily involved in our coverage of that with our colleague, Josh Kovensky. I believe we talked about a few of the people who were present, the former head of the Capitol Police. Sund is his last name, right?
Yep.
Forgetting his first name.
Stephen Sund, yeah, that's right.
And then one or both of the former sergeant-at-arms, is that right?
Both, though the Senate one stayed very under the radar during
right.
the hearing.
So, you know, there were still a lot of questions that came, you know, that are still, we still need answered after that hearing. And I think some of the most, I don't know, noteworthy moments included Senator Rob Portman Ron Johnson of Wisconsin reading a Federalist article, I think it was, you know, floating, maybe this was all like an Antifa ruse and all that. And, you know, he kind of stopped short of making those comments his own, but he certainly introduced them into the record kind of, you know, with the time he was allotted. Tell us, Kate, and for our listeners, kind of what some of the highlights were, if, you know, if our listeners weren't glued to the hearing all day yesterday, what should they take away from it? What should they kind of be aware of, where the investigation stands, kind of what happened and what we learned or didn't learn yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, we learned almost nothing. And part of it was that, you know, head of the Capitol Police, sergeants at arms, they all left their jobs days after the attack. So it's not like they're on the inside for what has transpired or been uncovered since. And then the other person who was there was the current acting head of the Metropolitan Police. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the big questions still went unanswered, and a ton of the senators basically asked versions of the same questions, which were, why did it take the National Guard so long to come? A big part of that is, what was Trump's role in deploying the National Guard or in interfering with the deployment? You know, that wasn't answered or even really addressed. And a lot of it was kind of finger pointing between these men who had their careers ended by this embarrassment. But, you know, an interesting piece was, yeah, you had Ron Johnson kind of reading the Antifa false flag conspiracy theory into the record, which is, you know, direct pipeline from QAnon to Republican lawmakers, which is kind of frightening. But, you know, I'm almost like, at least he stuck to his conspiratorial guns, you know, because then you had Hawley and Cruz going on about, like, thank you to the brave courage of our police officers who kept us safe on this day. And, you know, that's something I really hated about this hearing format is they were, you know, they were up on the dais with everybody else. They got to kind of assume the role of impartial questioner, of civil servant, you know, looking for accountability for this dreadful day. And none of that included any accountability of their own role, of their leading the charge and challenging the certification of the Electoral College votes, which is, you know, why the MAGA people were there and why they stormed the Capitol in the first place. And, you know, I was kind of thinking about it and thinking about my own queasiness watching them ask these questions and thinking, well, maybe that's not fair. Like, the point of this hearing is to get into the granular security failures. You know, why was the mob allowed to waltz into the Capitol so easily? What happened? And obviously, that's a big question. It's, like, shrouded in mystery. We've had very, very few public briefings on it at all. That's why they're, you know, thinking about setting up a commission, even though they're fighting about that now too. But, you know, I've just been kind of turning that over in my mind and thinking, you know, probably the best place for that accountability to have been delivered was the impeachment trial, because that wasn't about the TikTok of when did you call for National Guard backup and who did you ask. That was about proving the narrative that Trump incited this for months before it happened, you know, and in that narrative, Hawley and Cruz played starring roles in amplifying, stoking, etc. But then the impeachment managers made the kind of pragmatic decision not to include the Republican lawmakers in their presentation for the simple fact that those people were the jury and they didn't want to alienate votes. You know, even if the task was impossible, the managers went in with the job of winning over 17 Republicans to get a conviction. So they left the lawmakers out of it. And, you know, I wrote about this for members yesterday, but by the end of the day, yesterday, you were just like, well, there has been no accountability at all. You know, they had to kind of weather a couple tough op-eds from their hometown papers, and good on those papers. But, you know, Cruz has already weathered a whole nother scandal since then. It's just...
Weathered is a good word for that, too.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know. So, I mean... It ended up being kind of a frustrating exercise to me because we learned almost nothing. Everyone there kind of was there in their own self-interest and painting themselves in the best light possible, which resulted in basically everybody blaming it on intelligence lapses and the FBI, pretty much just because the FBI wasn't there. So they were, you know, easy to blame. But yeah, we didn't really come away knowing anything or knowing very much that we'd already... didn't know. It's just this like huge pit of questions that have not been addressed, and there hasn't even been what would be the more satisfying accountability from the senators involved. So
yeah, I'm curious, Kate, if you have a sense of why you think the Democrats on the committee didn't sort of more fulsomely bring up their colleagues Cruz and Hawley's role in kind of inciting the mob and what led to the actual violence. Is that just kind of collegiality, or, you know, that the witnesses, you know, they wanted to focus on the former officials they had in front of them? Do you have any sense of that?
I mean, with the exception of Johnson, most of the senators were actually trying to get at information from the witnesses they had there. So the only real opportunity for that would have been if they had chosen to kind of just use their 5 minutes to make a speech instead of trying to get information out, even though to some point maybe that would have been more effective, because you watch enough of these hearings and you're just like, you guys need to talk before you come to these, because there's like five questions that everybody asks in different versions. And you just start hearing the witnesses being like, yeah, you know, like I've said a few times, X, Y, Z. And you're just like, or, you know, or they need to be rewriting these on the fly or something to get more information out. I think pretty much the only nugget we learned was the FBI field office out of Norfolk, Virginia, wrote a threat assessment about the January 6th rally that's gotten a lot of attention now because it it included people calling for war, and was kind of indicative of the violence that would happen. And we learned from Sund that that report had made its way to Capitol Police, to their intel division, but had kind of died on the vine there and was never ran up the chain or anything. So that was kind of like the newest thing we learned.
And that was sent on the 5th of January, just a day before the actual insurrection, right?
Right. Though Sund has said kind of contradictory things about it, because he said before, if I had seen that, that would have informed our security planning and maybe changed how we did things. But then he said yesterday, all the intel that we saw is basically the same intel they saw before the million other MAGA marches that have happened here since the election, and none of those got as violent. So
it's this is the weird thing about this whole, like, you know, intelligence failure line, is that we knew that we didn't know this was going to happen, but we certainly knew this was a bigger deal than the other marches where they just had some kind of like brawls in the streets in the afternoon.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump's
Proud Boys.
Trump said as much. So, I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, sort of an open question, I guess, you know, whether the Capitol Police was really equipped in any, you know, in any sense to deal with something like this, as opposed to like, you know, you need to bring a National Guard or, you know, DC Metro or whatever. But I've seen a number of, actually, in a lot of cases, people involved in intelligence work say that this is just not what an intelligence failure means. You know, when if you don't pick up the phone, that's not an intelligence failure. That's just you goofed. Intelligence failure is like you have, you know, you had the information. You didn't put it all together. And this is just sort of like, well, you know, president said he was going to bring in have a wild day and you know, wanted everybody to come in to the city to kind of, you know, kind of make clear they couldn't make Biden president. Like, okay, yeah, that might get a little out of hand, right? I mean, it's just sort of, you know, and kind of who cares with these guys? I mean, like, I don't really care what the Sun guy knew or didn't know. I mean, you know, that does not have a larger significance to me, and I think that's probably the same, you know, for most people. And it's also the case that it's not like the Capitol was fully under Republican management. You know, the Speaker is a Democrat. You know, she has, I don't know exactly what the, you know, exactly what the distribution of authority there is. I mean, the Speaker is higher in the line of succession, but it's not like this was just Republicans saying, hey, everybody stand down, let them all come in, right? I mean, Democrats, Pelosi, you know, has a lot of, you know, input on this. So, but what you really want to know is, you really want to know about stuff with the president, stuff going on at the Pentagon, when were they asked, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's, I mean, are we going to have those hearings? Are those scheduled or what's...
Yeah, Klobuchar said yesterday that they're going to have Pentagon officials in next week. So, should be round two of this.
And then there's a separate House version of this hearing tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and the piece of this also that I'm really interested in that was not addressed yesterday, probably because everyone except for the Conti, who is the acting Metro, I just checked on that, but everyone else isn't in their jobs.
What I was confused about, I looked too, and I guess he's acting, but he replaced the guy like on the second. So this was just kind of a normal turnover.
Right, yeah.
Before
the
thing.
Not related to the insurrection.
Right, exactly. So it's not, he's not acting because of anything that happened on January 6th. He happened
just
to be just the act. Yes.
Yep, that's right. So, you know, a piece of this that Senator Jackie Rosen asked about, which I'm really interested in, is March 4th is when these like hardcore QAnoners think that Trump will be inaugurated as the 19th president, which I have also written about if you're interested. But that's our next kind of big date for these people. And she asked, like, what plans are being made to fortify the Capitol for that? And obviously, basically none of these people could speak to it because none of them have their jobs anymore. But that seems like a pretty important question to me, which I don't know. I would think that after something like January 6th that the agencies involved are now being hyper-vigilant, you know, based on the amount of fencing they have up and everything here. But, you know, I haven't seen that addressed too much, and I have absolutely no idea if anything is planned. But if you're one of these people who actually believes that your Lord and Savior is going to be ushered back into office on March 4th, that seems to me to be a good impetus to come to D.C. and watch. So, you know, I hope maybe next week that'll be addressed more fully, but, you know, something I have on my radar anyway.
Is March 4th Thursday or Friday next week? What's the actual day?
Oh my God, March is next week.
Is it March 1st on Monday, I want to say?
Unbelievable.
Coming up on a year of COVID.
Yeah, you're right. It's next Thursday. It's
March. Yeah, Monday, Thursday, right. Monday is March 1st.
Yeah.
Time flies. But yeah, no, that's a good point, Kate.
And I mean, you know, I have no idea. Again, this is in the province of kind of the hardcore QAnoner, so I don't even know if they'd be able to amass the kind of crowd that was there for January 6th, but, you know, it at least seems worth asking.
Right, and I guess seeing a couple hundred people get hit with federal charges might be a bit of a deterrent if you're just kind of like a casual Trump fan and are not kind of a hardcore wanting to storm the building kind of thing.
There's one data guy whose name... I think he's either from Israel or he has a Hebrew name. I don't remember offhand, but he was the guy who did this thread like 3 weeks before the insurrection. We basically predicted it down to like every, you know, down to the exact timing. I saw him do a tweet today basically saying he just doesn't think it's going to be at anything like the same scope, just because most, you know, kind of like your, for lack of a better word, mainstream MAGA type don't even know what March 4th is. You know, they're not even, it's not even on their radar. And, you know, Trump's not in office. There's no big, you know, kind of official rally to kind of, you know, be a magnet for it. So I suspect it's going to be pretty low energy if the, you know, if the point of comparison is January 6th. But again, kind of like...
Do you want to take a chance?
Yeah. Well, it's all, yeah, you can't, you can no longer say, kind of like, oh, what are they going to do, storm the Capitol? Well, okay, yeah, yeah, sure, why not, right? I mean...
Well, and not to mention that this conspiracy theory is clearly not as... widely believed as the election fraud conspiracy theory, but the people who do believe it are like kind of the nuttiest ones. So, you know, even if it's a smaller group, you don't want a small yet hardcore group of QAnon militants showing up. So I don't know. I'm sure they're, I would think that they'd be all over it at this point.
Kate, maybe we can, maybe a good place to end is you could tell us kind of what's going on with the 9/11 style independent commission looking into January 6th. I guess famously the 9/11 commission was split between Republican and Democratic appointees, I guess. Is that right? And Pelosi is looking at something like 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans. Am I right about
that?
Some kind of slightly uneven split. And so, like you said a little bit ago, there's sort of a fight brewing over that commission now too, but can you tell us the latest there, what we know so far about what's planned?
Yeah, well, so part of this was also spurred by the two guys whose names escape me right now who ran the 9/11 commission, the Democrat and the Republican, just gave either full interview or quotes to an outlet about how kind of the rosy eye, like, this worked really well for us. You know, we did majority vote on everything. It was an even split on the committee. And just kind of talking about how they really hope that the people who fill out this new committee are not partisans and blah, blah, blah. And doing that kind of thing of comparing a less polarized time with today, kind of. But I think it sparked renewed complaints from Republicans about what Pelosi is suggesting. In her proposed arrangement, Democrats are the only ones who would have subpoena power, which Republicans don't like. And there's already some kerfuffle over her tapping Lieutenant Governor Russell Honoré to spearhead the investigation into the security failures. He's well known for his role in kind of coming in during the nightmare Katrina response and being someone who was actually effective. And he's got this persona of like kind of a modern day cowboy. Like he curses a lot. He's very colorful, but you know, rough talking, but he gets things done is kind of his thing. For instance, he called Cruz and Hawley, he had this tweet calling them little pieces of shit that should be run out of D.C. Days before he was tapped from the commission. And Hawley spent a lot of his questioning kind of piling on him yesterday. But, you know, even before kind of that stuff came to light. There was a letter from some House Republicans like Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes types being mad at Pelosi for tapping him without, you know, even bothering to ask the minority. So it's this kind of thing that when it was first suggested, I think people were like, yeah, there's bipartisan desire for a commission to really get to the bottom of this. But now that we're getting into the nuts and bolts of it, it's devolving into, you know, Republicans kind of being mad that they're in the minority. And now that we have this backdrop of the rosy bipartisanship of yesteryear, it's kind of adding flame to their argument.
I think also, I mean, it's funny. I think I was just kind of trying to Google this while we were talking. Mm-hmm. I think it's Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with both these guys, and they're both like pretty, you know, pretty respectable types, you know, both a Republican or Democrat, but neither with a very strong partisan sort of shine to them. Hamilton was sort of like, I mean, he's almost 90 now, but he was kind of like the Democrats' foreign policy dude in an earlier era. And Tom Keene was sort of like a Northeastern moderate governor of New Jersey way, way, way back when. I kind of get what they're talking about, but these dudes are both from like a different, you know, land of the lost, right? I mean, different, very different time that is just not like today. And frankly, I mean, people need to say the elephant in the room. The Republicans were behind it. Al-Qaeda didn't get any representation on the 9/11 commission. It was just Americans, you know, just Americans who were not with Al-Qaeda. And, you know, it's not exactly the same, but it's not exactly different either. And that's just a fact. And I guess, you know, the tradition is these commissions should, you know, generally are bipartisan. And I guess the take is she wants to do it more like a committee. You know, Democrats are in the majority. That is what it is. And I hope, and if I know Pelosi, you know, what she's like, she doesn't tend to put up a lot of bullshit. Like once she doesn't go fast enough for a lot of people, but once she decides on something, she doesn't put up with much bullshit at all, especially not this kind of like kabuki kind of nonsense, right? And I think she should just do that. I mean, let's be honest. Most Republicans were complicit in it. Some actually participated in it. And the great majority don't want to get to the bottom of it because they're behind it. I mean, that's just a fact. And like I said, Bin Laden didn't get to nominate anybody for the 9/11 commission. That's not how it works. Who gives a fuck what they say? They're not gonna participate in good faith anyway. And Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene. I remember that era. A lot of good things about that era. We're not living in that era. That's just a joke. These people are so alien to our current politics. I can't even really begin to describe.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost reminiscent to me of when we were coming into, you know, the days before Biden was inaugurated. And there were all these stories about basically how is the Senate going to operate with 50-50 split. And then there was all these stories talking to, you know, Law and Daschle about how they did it the last time there was a 50-50 split. And it's these stories that are almost, you know, quaint looks into how polarized we've become. But what use is it? You know, I mean, you're completely right. And Pelosi knows that, you know, she knows that Republicans most of them were either complicit or active participants. Like you could name on one hand the Republicans who actively spoke out against the election fraud line, and you probably wouldn't fill up all five fingers. So, I mean, no, I don't think Pelosi is going to back down from this. And I think Republicans were going to find any excuse to call this commission bipartisan anyway, so they can dismiss the inevitable findings that Republicans had a hand in it. So I'm almost just like, do what you got to do and see if you can get us any relevant information, because this is pretty much the last, it seems, congressional opportunity to get any accounting of what happened, both because I think the further out we get, the more the political will diminishes. And then there's also just a ton of other stuff that the administration is trying to do. So, I mean,
and the midterms come up and that right, just makes exactly. it harder too.
So I think she'll probably push ahead with the way it is and Republicans will disavow it. And that's
the other, you know, the other thing is that generally speaking, how this works is Pelosi doesn't pick the Republicans.
Right.
Kevin McCarthy picks them. I mean, basically they, you know, the caucus picks it, but they pick it. And given the dynamics currently, it is an absolute given. It's going to be like, you know, Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes. There's no way they're going to put on that Kinsinger guy or Liz Cheney or something like that. There's going to be a huge demand on that side to put in, you know, hardcore MAGA types who have as their sole agenda protecting President Trump.
Right.
And that is just a given.
It's so almost like those committees that were looking into Russia, you know, they would like do these big kind of investigations and then you would have the Republicans present their findings and the Democrats present their findings as if they weren't the same body of findings. You know, I think we're like probably in store for something like that.
Yeah, I would say I really think, unfortunately, we're in a situation where they should just appoint the people they want to appoint, do a real investigation, have only one report. I mean, they can, you know, Republicans can do something kind of on their own, but no official, you know, one official report, and that's it. And just let the report speak for itself. And they can disavow it, but if it's a good report, the sort of the facts will,
exactly.
you know, for people who actually want to pay attention to what happened, the facts will speak for themselves.
Yep.
I mean, we know no Republican who is going to be on that committee is going to approach it as a fact-finding exercise. We know that. I believe that there are a significant number of Republicans who are still really pissed about what happened and would like to get to the bottom of it. But they are either in the process of being purged from the party or they have to keep their mouth shut because it's basically been embraced by the Republican Party. Even down to the point of, you know, if you say it was Antifa, that counts as embracing it.
Yeah.
Because you're willing to say things that are completely nonsense to defend the perpetrators.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good place to leave it. Kate, keep us posted. And maybe in subsequent episodes, we can dig in more to the commission as it takes shape.
I will.
Yeah, remember, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. All right.
Talk to you next
later,
week.
Later, folks.
Bye, guys.